Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Halloween Day, Friday, October the 31st. I'm going to try and record this opening as fast as possible because my neighbors are having, evidently, the most landscaping ever done in the history of landscaping done today. I've been trying to record this open for a few hours now, and it just keeps getting louder. So let's get to it. Welcome back. And with that, with all the, I'm not sure if you can hear my dogs. My dogs are going insane too. So Ellen Ronka was on the podcast several weeks ago. She came back. We wanted to deep dive into answering a few questions. And a lot of this had to do with the shame overwhelm cycle, sort of continuing on that. But overall, just diving quite a bit deeper into what we had talked about before. So responding to indecisiveness, again, the shame overwhelm cycle. There's just a lot of really, really good stuff. It was great having her around. You can find her, by the way, at chronictocure.com. And I'm going to link that in the show notes. So listen to Ellen Ronka and I, part two. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I've had a lot of repeat guests over the years. I've got another repeat one today. Ellen Ronka is back. Can you hear me?
I can.
I don't know what I told you that I was listening to our last episode while I was running this morning. And I listen to all my podcasts on 1.5x because a lot of the ones that I listen to are very long. Like we did 52 minutes last time. I'm talking like hour and a half, 2 hours. And most of the ones that I listen to are like about professional wrestling, which is a little geeky, whatever. But I got to be able to get through them pretty quick. Like, you know, I've got 10 that I listen to a week and I walk the dogs every day and it's only 35 minutes. I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to get through those. And I kept saying, I was saying Ellen Ronka in the beginning. And for some reason, my brain kept going to Almond Roca every time I would say it was what I kept. I don't know if you've ever heard that before or ever even had that thought, but.
Too funny. I've not had that thought, but it's going to be hard to get out of my brain now. Thanks.
Well, and actually the person that I had on my podcast a few months ago, Skylar, who introduced me to, I had never heard your name before and she raved about you. And the first time she said the name, I was like, did she just say Almond Roca? No, that's not what she said. So,
you know, the funny thing is that when I'm trying to get people to know how to spell my name, I'll say that like, you know, like Tonka Trucks and then be like, you know, or Willy Wonka and then, you know, because I'm a big dark chocolate fan. But, you know, I don't really want to be associated with either of those. But, you know, Almond Roca isn't going to get us to spell it any better. So
I guess I haven't looked in a toy section. Are Tonka Trucks still around?
Oh, I would have assumed, but maybe not. No, I mean,
you never know. Let me tell you, a lot of the cool stuff is not around anymore. So don't get your hopes up.
Okay.
Okay. Moments after we recorded the last podcast, I sent you an email and I said, hey, something that I want to learn more about that we really just grazed and I want to get your take on and have that kind of be the jump off point for us. Was around people being okay with not being liked, essentially the opposite of a people pleaser. And I want to dive more into that. So start us out.
All right. Well, do you want to tell me what hangs you up on it?
I think it was just interesting because I haven't heard, I think that's sort of a necessary skill. And part of me would just be led to believe that that's just something that comes with life experience, like the longer that you're alive, assuming that you, like, you know, kids, if you're a teenager, you want to fit in, right? So like, you kind of want to be liked. But as time goes on, as you become an adult, you would think that, and I know this isn't the case, which I can see the expression on your face, this is not the case. You would think that the case would be that people grow out of that. And there would become a time where they're sort of like, I don't really care what other people think, or I don't really care if I'm pleasing people, but I know that that probably is not the case for a lot of people.
Well, it might well be if you're an intentionally growing person, but not everyone is.
Yeah.
And also, I think not everyone gets the same quality of help or, you know, finds the right resources to help them grow out of things like that. But let's frame this up because I want to make sure people, our listeners, understand the context because we're like, we just came back into this deep dive and I want people to understand that we were talking about this in the context of I think I said something pretty bold, which is, I still stand by it, that in order to heal from mind-body symptoms, which is to say chronic symptoms, right? Symptoms that don't have a structural cause, disease, infection, something like that, a tumor in your body, which a lot of people, even with neuroplastic neural circuit problems, mind-body symptoms, still tend to think there's a structural problem in their body. But if it's going on for months, if not years, most certainly it is mind-body, or not most certainly, almost certainly. And so it's worth understanding what's driving that, right? Because you can recover from those things. And what I was saying is, you can't recover, my opinion, unless you get comfortable with disappointing people or having other people disapprove of you. And that was the context, right? Because I'm really the context we were talking about is shame, the emotion of shame. Very often people hear, they don't recognize shame because it comes in the form of thoughts about ourselves, right? I suck, you know, people are judging me. I failed, I'm inadequate, I'm unworthy, I don't deserve X, Y, Z. And very often it doesn't even really exactly show up in those words until they try to express how they feel to someone else. They just know they feel gross.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get out of that feeling. So, so your question is about, it's true. I think for people who are consistently growing people, yes, the older they get, the more likely they will have to gotten to this point of being able to tolerate other people's disapproval. But my experience is you get that skill by working on it. And I've known a lot of people, if they get the right help, they can grow out a lot sooner. It's not necessarily an age thing. So I'm all about being very intentional about that, because I think that feeling of shame or fear of other people's judgment or disapproval is what drives all mind-body symptoms. That's my hypothesis, or my thesis.
What are some things that people can do to get out of that? I mean, other than seek help, right? So like one continuous feedback that I get from people that listen to this podcast, and when I have therapists on, is I think that, and this is a whole deeper discussion about the cost of really everything for people, but a lot of people that will email me or message me will say that ultimately getting help is very cost prohibitive. And so it becomes challenging and almost self-defeating for a lot of people. Because like, you know, there's resources I can get free information on the TMS Wiki. I can journal for free. I can do all this, but I'm not making any progress. So that's some feedback a lot of times. So like, being able to work on a skill like that, what sort of things can people do? I'm sure it's like, it's got other, in the absence of working with a professional, it's got to be a lot of little things that add up over time, just repetition, 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 right?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for framing up the context, because now I know better how to speak to your audience. So the first thing is, you have to recognize that when you're feeling shame, that you're feeling shame. And because most people are cowed by it, because it comes in the form of thoughts like, I suck, I'm not good enough, that kind of thing. Too fat, don't make enough money, like those kinds of icky self-referencing thoughts.
Just the constant self-prodding over and over.
All that. Yes. Nicely put. And the first thing I want those people to know, and I put myself in that those people category, because for years and years I struggled with this, is that it's just an obsessive thought, but it really comes from the emotion of shame. So, well, let me back up. Sometimes we end up like getting really immersed in the feeling of shame. Like you just, oh man, you said the wrong thing and you just feel disgusting about yourself. That's kind of one version of shame. But then this like constant, what did you just call it? That constant
prodding,
inner
poking, prodding. Yeah.
What I call the shame gremlin, just not constantly at you in the back of your head. Let's start with that one. It's an obsessive thought and you don't have to think it. Like thoughts really are behaviors and you don't have to engage them. And most times people engage them by trying to argue with them or believing them, one way or another. And if you can get a little bit of distance, which is hard because shame is the most compelling emotion, in my opinion, that, and again, I'm just calling it an emotion, but it shows up for most people as thoughts.
Yeah.
So if you recognize the thoughts, And usually not thinking something never works for people, they actually have to do something different. And so the something different is send yourself love. And by love, I mean empathy, because I think empathy is the purest form of love. Like, you really see yourself and your struggle and your suffering. And it sort of dodges the whole issue of, am I good enough? And it just says, I see your struggle.
Yeah.
So the most basic thing, and this is honestly how I arrived at how to heal from chronic shame, is honestly, yes, I learned from Brené Brown how to understand shame. But then it was when I understood pain reprocessing therapy and how you train your brain out of any kind of sensation. I do exactly the same with shame. So in other words, with chronic, any kind of chronic sensation, let's call it back pain just for ease, okay? Or I don't know, foot pain. What do you think is your most common listener's issue? Knee pain, foot pain, because you get a lot of runners or lifters.
That's super. Let's say shoulder. Let's say shoulder.
So if we've, you know, and I don't want to assume too much on the other hand, it's a short podcast. So we, let's just assume we know this is a mind-body symptom. It's not neuroplastic, right? Yeah. It is neuroplastic. Once we know that we absolutely have to arrive at that in order to train out of the sensation, you know, as long as we're thinking it's a structural problem, there's a problem in my shoulder, I got to go get an MRI and then I got to get surgery or I got to get an injection, blah, blah, blah. We're cooked. We're not going to heal from that mind-body symptom. Okay. But once we recognize, okay, it's really mind body, it's driven by something, it's driven by my brain, a neural circuit in my brain, then you can disregard the sensation and keep moving. And what I'm saying is the parallel here is with shame, what happens is people get caught up in the message of it, which is I suck in some version, you know, which is the equivalent of like, uh-oh, there's a problem with my shoulder.
Yeah.
And instead of doing that, you say, I don't have to listen to this message. It's an old neural circuit. I learned that from my childhood, or I learned that from my, you know, my ex or whatever. I don't have to listen to the message of that. It's irrelevant. And then just like in pain reprocessing therapy, one of the big, you know, tools is safety messaging. I'm actually, because if pain is a danger signal, the way you respond to the danger signal to turn it down is to say, hey, I'm actually safe. Brain, limbic brain, I don't really need you firing off, giving me a, you know, some kind of alarm. I don't need that. Thank you very much. You know, you can keep going if you want. That's that outcome independence thing. So with shame, with a consistent shame-based message, the equivalent of that safety message is actually empathy, because empathy is the antidote to shame.
Are there close cousins of shame? Like, you talk, like, the kind of the story that you've been talking about is the constant prodding, the gremlin, right? Over and over and over. Like, that's, as people are listening to this, they're probably remembering or identifying ways that they do that to themselves, or that they kind of hear that voice over and over. What is maybe a close equivalent? That might be a tough question. A close equivalent to that. It's not the gremlin, but it's something, not a physical pain, but it's something similar that, okay, the shame goes, like we call it the, in the TMS Dr. Sarno world, we refer to this as the, symptom imperative, meaning your knee pain goes away, but you now get ankle pain, or you now get elbow pain, or something like that. What is something that is close in nature to the shame piece that somebody, they might be successful in getting the gremlin to shut up, but then they get something else?
Well, it's interesting, because any kind of obsessive thinking. So like it's really common for people with neuroplastic symptoms, symptom imperative, they resolve the sensation, the pain maybe, or the GI issue, and then they end up with OCD. You know, they get really obsessive about germs or something else. Or in my case, obsessive decision-making style. Like, I got to get that decision right.
How does this stuff relate? This just popped in my mind. How does this stuff relate to, I think that one of the overall themes a lot of like, I don't know if I'd call them TMS-y people, but people in general, TMS-y. I know that your work didn't originate because of John Sarno, but hey, that seems like it fits.
We can coin that. Yeah, I'm good with that.
I got to apply the trademark before I put this podcast
on. Right? Honestly.
But a necessity for control. I always got to control something. So there's like, I've had experts that have talked about eating disorders on this podcast before. We talk about the necessity for control. It sounds like some of the stuff that you're talking, like, I got to get this deadline, right? They can control those things. And then OCD sounds similar, where if I can always control my hand washing or me being vigilant over germs, or I could think about like dieting in a lot of ways is very, and I've had people that are experts on that that have come on and they've talked about that. And I think all these things are equivalencies. So do you mind talking about the necessity for control a little bit?
Sure. I mean, so much of this is about not being able to tolerate uncertainty, right? I'm not certain this person still likes me if I say no to them. I'm not certain if I'm going to get sick because I just touched that doorknob. I'm not certain if, what was an example you just gave me? If my shoulder, is my shoulder really hurt? Did I just work it a little too hard yesterday? Is it really torn? It might be torn. I may need surgery. Really, bottom line is so much of what, you're exactly right. The undergirding pattern is the brain gets on a glitch. You know, it's sort of like the record that keeps skipping with the scratch in it. And it just keeps replaying the same worry. It's fear-based, right? So whether it's about whether someone likes me enough, whether I ate too many calories today, did I exercise enough today, it really doesn't matter. And this is why, sort of psychologically speaking, on the one hand, it's fascinating to do a deep dive in helping people heal from chronic physical symptoms. The truth is, you're exactly right. All of these things are mechanisms by which the unconscious distracts us from the real issue. Yeah. And the real issue is something's not okay. Yeah. Like at really base level. And very often there's some emotional something that's driving it. So on the one hand, sometimes this prodding of that shame-based thinking is just, it's a learned neural circuit. You just got it from childhood because that's what was role modeled for you. Or maybe you had someone constantly giving you negative feedback, so you learned it. But very often it's there taking up RAM so you don't actually have to look at the thing underneath. And so this mind-body work, again, you're exactly right, whether you're trying to solve for an eating disorder or chronic shoulder pain or OCD of any variety or any other symptom like IBS or whatever, the way Sarno talked about it is like your unconscious thinks it's basically has assessed the situation as it's safer to feel these physical symptoms than to actually face the emotion. Personally, and I know it's like, you know, risky to be challenging what Sarno said, but I much prefer to think of it as their messages as opposed to my unconscious is trying to fool me. I prefer to think of it as like an organic dream. When I say organic, I mean a dream is sort of in your mind, right? You wake up and you're thinking like, I wonder if that's like my unconscious trying to get through to me. I think our body symptoms are like that all the time.
Yeah.
I understand that very often they do serve that way because we can get in a flurry about them and we want them gone. And so they do actually have that distracting quality about them. And there are some people that I think, wow, their unconscious is really like, it's so obvious that it's resistance. But in so many people's cases, like as I was listening to you talking about your foot pain and your F off, episode, you don't want this thing. You're trying to get to the bottom of it. You're doing your best. I don't really think your unconscious is trying to fool you. I think your unconscious only has certain ways to communicate, and your body is the primary one. Your body is, in the way I think of it, as your unconscious manifest.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you have anything that's taking up gobs of space, and it could, by the way, be a behavior, you know, scrolling too much, gaming too much to the point where you're not, you know, doing your life responsibilities. It could be really any addictive behavior. All of those just point back to, what are you avoiding? So, yes, I think there are parallels everywhere. And so I was, you know, when you and I got into this shame piece, some of it is learned neural network. A lot of people walk around saying, I have low self-esteem and I don't know what to do about that. Well, I, you know, the way you train out of shame is the way you train out of pain. And if you know that because of listening to your podcast, then cool, you know how to train out of shame. But really the bigger issue is, and I think this is why people without professional help sometimes don't get anywhere, is because those unconscious factors, they're unconscious. You're blind to them. Other people may not be if they listen to you long enough, but you are because they're your unconscious factors.
Yeah.
So that's really the trick is, and I think that's why journaling in this field is so big, because if you can really journal, let yourself go and really just blah out, you're more likely to be able to get to the unconscious factors as you go. Because if you're really just flat out honest with yourself and you're willing to look at what you're seeing. So if you ask me what's the best way, you know, without spending any money, and most people don't like it, they don't want a journal, but I think that's one of the least, I always call journaling like the cheapest, most powerful healthcare intervention you can do.
what's your, cause like, and I sort of talked about this the last time, but like Nicole Sachs is kind of the, you know, she's sort of the Mother Teresa on journaling, at least in this world. And so that's her thing. Like, that's what she talks about. It doesn't sound like specifically, well, maybe that's your thing. Maybe you prescribe that to people to do. I don't know. But I tend to, my mom, for instance, has talked to me about journaling in the past. This is like way pre-Sarna. This is just, you know, me as a teenager, me in my 20s or whatever. Her talking about how she kept a journal for decades, right? But in hearing some of the entries of that, it sounds like it's largely a storytelling device, like a vessel to tell, here's what went on in my day, here's what I ran into, that kind of thing. When people hear journaling, I think that's what they think about. Similar to like a teenager's diary, right? You're telling a story of what happened. And people can't see you shaking your head no, but I know, but I think I know what you mean. What would be a... Here's how you journal, and I know that's probably too in depth for a, you know, a short form.
No, podcast, I think I can do that justice pretty quickly.
Okay.
First thing is, you don't get to judge yourself. Plain and simple, no holds barred. You got to say exactly what you're feeling in the moment, and you don't literally get to judge yourself. It's against the rules. Now you are going to, but as soon as you catch yourself doing it. And doing this kind of journaling with the intent not to judge yourself will gradually help you see how often you judge yourself. But the first thing is you got to write everything how you really feel about things. Forget what happened. We don't have to lay out the story. It's only for you. And at that, a lot of people destroy it. So there's no point in writing what happened.
So this you is, only write this what, is no holds barred. Say whatever you want about someone, a situation, a person, or someone close to you, someone you love. Like, it doesn't matter, right?
Let it rip, balls to the wall, the whole, whatever language you want to use.
Yeah.
If you're mad, you're mad. If you think the whole world is ending and you're always going to feel this way, write that. You know, like, you got to get in your, it's the thing that really hangs people up with journaling is, one, either they start writing like that and they're like, I don't know how to get out. I'm like, I'm in a morass of yuck and I don't know how to bring myself out. Or they're terrified of what they're going to write about, because if they start talking about their childhood, oh my gosh, that's terrifying. I don't want to feel all that again. No, thank you very much. Or other people just go completely blank. They, you know, dissociate, or they just really don't know how to feel their feels. So on the one hand, yes, if you can get into your feels and if you can have this rule for yourself to not judge yourself, it'll be productive. But so many, that this is why the professional help often is needed, because as kids, and this, I really want to make this point clear, really clear, that although it's true that having really complex developmental trauma growing up, you know, verbal abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, watching mom and dad fight, that kind of stuff, not having a mom and dad, or poverty, you name it, those kinds of things, that definitely sets you up for mind-body symptoms.
The ACEs is what you're talking about. Adverse childhood experiences.
Yes, yep. Thank you. Exactly. But if you don't have any of those, there's a very good chance still, if you have chronic symptoms, you almost certainly didn't have one really key important ingredient, which is why I'm so big on talking about shame. That key ingredient being empathy, or being attuned to by your parents. Like, someone's really noticing your emotions. Someone sees you, who you are. Not for what you do. Oh, you wash the dishes. Good job, Johnny. No. you really notice who Johnny is, and you love him unconditionally. And you notice when Johnny's down, when Johnny's excited, and you can reflect that and you mirror that. That is what we call attunement. And that is essential for not just emotional health, but physical health, believe it or not. That's what the ACEs study shows, right? And the more ACEs you have, the more inclined you're to have those same problems too. But very often what people miss is that I didn't have any of those, I don't have that many ACEs. Why do I feel terrible in my body all the time? Yeah. It's probably because you missed this one key ingredient that's more important than anything else.
The attunement.
And that's attunement. Yeah. And this is why I'm so passionate about, see, if you don't have attunement, you're going to be prone to shame. Plain and simple. We can just draw a line between the two, because shame is about not being able to see yourself and feel okay with you. And if you didn't get that role modeled for you, and if you didn't get someone reflecting that you're a very special, unique, beautiful human, you're not going to be able to do that for yourself unless you do a whole lot of healing work. And when you can't do it for yourself, what you end up with is all this niggling, shame-based thinking. And right now you're probably thinking, but just about everybody I know has that. And I'm like, yeah, because it takes very special parents to give that quality of attunement that people really need.
So without that attunement, this continuous cycle of shame, essentially the antidote is, or what you're saying, the antidote is the empathy for self.
Yes, which connects you to yourself, which keeps you attuned to yourself. Now, for people first learning that, it's going to feel obnoxious, because my experience is people are like, gosh, damn it, I didn't get it when I was supposed to. Now I got to do it for myself and my kids. Like, that really pisses them off totally. I get it 100%.
Empathy overload.
When I landed on this, I just resisted it. And here's the other thing. When you're really in a vat of shame, when you're just feeling totally disgusting about yourself, it really helps to have someone outside yourself to come along and say, you know what? I still think you're awesome. I love you. And I'm right here with you. And you may feel disgusting about you, but I don't feel that way with you, and be with you, right? When you're it's awesome if you have that person, or just even one, but if you're borrowing it from another person all the time, I'm just based on my clinical experience and my personal experience inside my own head and heart, it's not the same when you're relying on other people. You're really very dependent on that other person. You learn the skill. So I'm all about teaching that skill. And honestly, I might even go so far, I don't know. I might say that if you learn how to do self-empathy, so back to what's the cheapest path to healing if you don't have professional help, all day long, empathy, every which way from Sunday. But it's got to be high quality empathy, not what I call cheerleading, not trying to talk yourself out of the icky feelings, none of that, none of this reassurance stuff that is good, but it's not empathy. And if you can do empathy that consistently, the only other thing I think you really, because then that means you're going to be able to process your feelings, you're going to be able to see yourself, not judge yourself, all those other things fall into place. The only other thing I'd say you really need is the pain science, so that you understand that just because there's pain in your body doesn't mean there's actually a problem in the tissues of your body. You have to have that information. You have to understand what that means, you know, how to reinterpret those signals. But in my opinion, those two things,
Give me two examples here. We're both going to play the role of, did you see that?
That was you.
Both my hands are, I'm not touching anything.
I know. You went up with your finger like this, and we just got balloons go across.
A bunch of balloons just came across the screen. I was like, what the hell's behind me? I don't know. That was funny.
I've had it happen a few times in a therapy session until I learned how to turn that setting off.
Okay. I don't know what caused it. Was it my fingers? It wasn't my fingers. I don't know. Give me two. So I'm going to give you two examples. We're both going to play the part of, I'm going to be shameful, Eddie. You're going to be empathetic, Eddie. Too shameful, Eddie. Because I want people to kind of understand what this may look like for them.
Sure. And what we're saying is I'm how you should be responding to yourself, or
how you could. I don't know. I don't like the word should. So
I'm with you. I love that. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah. Nicole Sachs actually says shooting all over yourself. is what.
It's not a Nicoleism. It's earlier than that in the therapy world, but I don't remember who actually said it. But he used to say, you know, stop shooting on yourself.
Yeah. In front of me, so I've got three monitors in front of me. You're on one. The right side is my job. The left side is soccer coaching kids, which we talked a little bit about. So I'm going to use the two from the above. So this is a disclaimer. I've actually had a very good sales year this year, but the salesperson is always a great critic of themselves. You know, because there is a quota. There's either you did it or you didn't do it. Sure. So say I'm sitting here, I'm wallowing. I've had an awful month or quarter or year, whatever. And I suck at sales. I can't do this. Nobody buys from me. I'm terrible at this. What would empathetic, like what, how can I come to the rescue of myself? Not even the rescue of myself, but how can I help counter some of that continuous, you know, the gremlin over and over?
Yep. You catch yourself in it. You say, oh, these are shame-based thoughts. Oh, not just shame-based thoughts, but I'm in shame, right? So that's first step. Second step, empathy. So, oh man, it is so hard to do a job where I'm constantly being measured and worried about measuring up. It's hard, and it's hard to balance a lot of stuff in life. And I can see you're really struggling with the results you got this year, quarter, day. I see you. It's hard.
Contrast that with, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, if instead of doing that, I said to myself, You went to President's Club 7 times. You've done this. You know what you try and do. Almost out logic that yes. Shame feeling. How? Yep. Why is that detrimental?
That's such a good question. I'm so glad you asked. Because basically, you're trying to argue down the shame, and with any obsession, which I believe these shame based thinking is, you're increasing it by doing that. Because really, what you're doing is you're just measuring yourself still. You're still reinforcing the idea that I'm only good enough if I met a certain quota or criteria. So, and this is why I think so many people who are quote unquote successful in the world struggle with shame, because they don't see that. They're flip sides of the same coin. Whether you're succeeding or failing, you're still measuring yourself. And so I'd rather have you say to emphasize your values or... Like if you're, are you saying you're what, you had those shame-based thoughts and then you tried to talk yourself out of them by saying, well, you did at President's Club, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
Or are you saying this day I'm like, I did this, I did that, I did that, I did that. Which are you saying?
Probably more the former. Okay. More the former.
So I wouldn't really argue it down, because I don't think it's going to work. Because here's why. Arguing with emotions doesn't work. If your kid is disappointed it's raining on their birthday, oh, honey, we'll still have a good time inside the house. It's not going to cut it.
Still sucks.
Don't do that. Yeah. Yes, please, people, don't argue with your kids' emotions. Don't do it. That is the lack of attunement exactly that I'm talking about. And I know that you really mean well. But here's what it should sound like. Oh, honey, I totally get it. It sucks when it rains on your birthday and you had a... you know, jumpy house planned and all the things, right?
Yeah.
I'm so disappointed with you. Of course, you name the emotion for them. I know it's disappointing. I know. You be with them. See, what happens is when you counter the emotion, what they ended up feeling is invalidation. It's wrong for me to be disappointed. Oh, come on. We'll still have a good time. We'll make balloons inside the house. You just... not just invalidated your kid, you did not attune to your kid. And I know parents now are listening and they're probably scared that, you know, their kid will end up in this big morass of disappointment they'll never be able to get out. It's exactly the opposite. It's totally counterintuitive. I get it. But actually what happens is when you pull your kid into you and you say, oh, it's so disappointing when it rains on your birthday, isn't it? When your kid can really feel that, the emotion drains out of them. And then after you let them cry, you know, go ahead and cry. It's disappointing. Of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah. What do you want to do with that disappointment? You got any ideas? Let them come up with it. I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe we can splash in mud puddles. I don't know. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. If you come against the emotion, you are in effect, even though you're trying to be there for your kid, you're not attuned. And when we do that to ourselves as an adult, we're perpetuating the same thing, and we will not get out of shame. Just because I tried it for years. Whereas when you say, it's really hard to have a goal and not meet it, and also be struggling because you're trying to balance so many things. You're a parent, you're a coach, blah, blah. See, that's empathy. I get why you're disappointed. You really wanted to meet the goal. You wanted that bonus. I totally get it. When you can do that for yourself, then, yeah, you can be like, you know what? I'm really proud of myself, though, because I lived my values this quarter. And so, okay, I didn't make them. That's not empathy, but it is seeing yourself. You know what? The reason why I got these results is because I didn't work 80 hours a week. I wanted to be a present parent. And that's, do you see how that's seeing yourself?
Yeah.
So at the end of the party, and you say to your kid, I know it rained, but how'd you do? And your kid's like, well, I kind of had fun playing the blah, blah, blah inside the house. And you're like, you know what? Look at you. You did a really, you made the best of blah, blah, blah. You're emphasizing values. You know, I think that's really powerful. I love that you were able to laugh with your friends, even though it rained outside, you know, that.
Okay. The other example, I feel like it's going to be similar, but, God, you are terrible at coaching. You lose every game. You suck. You suck.
Mm-hmm.
The empathetic to that?
Can I turn this on you and do what I do with my clients and ask you to do it for yourself?
Hey, open book. By the way, this is not rhetoric that I say to myself. This is, I believe that there are probably lots of, in fact, I converse quite often with a guy who coaches boys soccer that listens to this show. So I coach girls, he coaches boys. It's, you know, what it is, what it is, whatever. But yes, go for it.
But Millie, I mean, you're not just, it's thousands, millions. Like, this is how most people, it's the lowest common denominator way to think. It takes effort to not do this. So most people do, and you can hear it in how they talk about themselves. People who over apologize, for example, you know. So you tell me, if you catch yourself thinking those thoughts, how would you turn it around?
Well, I say unfortunately, because we just talked about not trying to counter it, but I literally, what I would say to myself is, I would say, did all the kids from last year return? The answer is yes. And that would be the case closed.
See, and if that works for you, cool. But I'm just saying that for people with like an obsessive style or sort of very persistent shame-based thinking, that's only going to encourage it.
Well, and again, like, this is not something that I have said it to myself, it's been years, because I actually don't think that that's true. We do lose a lot, but I don't think there's anything wrong with, I think we can always improve as coaches, as people, whatever. Like, I do continuing education and all that, but I don't know if it were my kid and I were watching from afar, I would think, I don't know if we could do any better. It sounds really arrogant, but I think that that is the case. So I don't have this kind of dialogue to myself, or I haven't in a long, long, long time.
Yeah. So in other words, I remember in our first episode, you gave this example of feeling a little bit squeamish. You didn't use that word, but driving away when you had to jet out of your
Because I was going to the Littles game. Yeah. I think it was after that weekend. Yeah.
Isn't this like, there's like, it's in the little cracks and corners of this, like, what do people think about the fact that I jetted out, right? Yep. So it's not as compelling for you, because it sounds like you've probably done a lot of work on it, but it's sort of like, so again, this is a continuum. There are people who like sort of soak in that vat of shame all day long. And then the other end of the spectrum is people who live in what I call operate in their worthiness most of the time. And every once in a while, I have a blip of shame. And that's where we want to be. But and the way to get there is, one, to recognize that obsessive thinking and just not indulge it. But when there's a really, like what you're describing is a big, ugly moment where I'm like, I suck as a coach. We lost again. I must really suck at this, that kind of thing. Again, those are the thoughts that go with shame. It's hard, you know. Look at you. You're trying really hard, and it's hard to keep not winning. It feels like the measurement of who you are, and that stinks. Like, it feels really gross to have winning and losing as the measurement of your worth. Do you see how that like steps out of, am I really worthy? And it gets into kindness towards yourself about the fact that you're even on this, you're even measuring yourself with the ruler.
Yeah.
So I say like, sidestep the ruler and be kind to yourself. And sometimes that's like, maybe like in your case, telling yourself the truth that, you know, the kids all returned and the parents seem to like you. Okay. But I don't really think that repairs this tendency to go to shame.
I'd be curious to know how I would feel if I decided at some point, which is not out of the question, to coach something where the kids are older or the environment is much more competitive.
That's a good question.
I'm in rec. So like, it kind of isn't about, it's like, are the kids exercising, having a good time? Are they coming back? Are they enjoying themselves? Are they, you know, like we never get blown out. So it's not like if, like there's this poor team, we close the season against this team and I, you know, we have the standings. And so I can see how many goals did they score versus how many do they give up? Most teams are going to be there's a super good team and there's a super bottom team. And we're closing the season against a super bottom team where, you know, they've scored 3 and they've given up 60. You know what I mean? Like, So it's not like that. And I don't know how I would feel, because winning and losing is not what it's all about. If I were getting drilled every single game, I think I would feel differently. But if I were in a more competitive environment, say these are late high school kids that are trying to get a scholarship or like something like that.
Yeah, like stakes, a travel team where people pay a lot of money for their kid to be learning from you. And
yeah, maybe the stakes might feel higher then. And again, it may come at some point. It's nowhere even remotely on my radar of wanting to, because I kind of do like that this isn't a year-round thing. And when we get to the end of 14 weeks, I can breathe a couple months, you know?
You know, I really appreciate your self-honesty with that, because I do think, you know, most of us aren't shame-based about everything. Like, there are certain things we decide we don't care about, you know? And then there are certain things we really do care about. And people get fixated on certain things, you know, how clean their house is, or that their hair looks neat as a pin, or whatever, or how fit they are. You know, we pick our things. And then the other things, because you can't possibly work towards perfection on everything. So in your case, what you're saying is, yeah, but, you know, if there were more eyes on me and there's higher stakes, maybe I would. And I think that's probably true.
Sure.
So. Where does that leave us? Because I know you're like, I want to keep this short, but we're not short. I do want to just say that when it comes to this like obsessive thought process, we can do it with indecision. We can do it with any kind of anything that we get really hooked into, and it just distracts us from what really matters. Okay. But two things that I think, two emotions that I think really hang people up because of shame, like because of not recognizing them, was, I already mentioned disappointment, like in the example of your kid getting their party getting rained on. That's a big part of my shame process, I think, got set up because my parents did not know how to handle my disappointment.
Yeah.
It never actually rained on a party, but it did, you know, blizzard of 78. It snowed for three days.
What's your birthday?
February 7th.
Oh, yeah. It's a terrible time. I'm sorry.
Totally. Oh, my gosh. You have no idea. Like, I rescheduled my birthday and the postponed birthday got snowed out, too. It happens every year. So disappointment. But here's the thing. There's the disappointment. And then there's, if your parent doesn't attune to the disappointment, if they don't know how to tolerate the disappointment, you end up feeling shame, too. Because they're trying to talk you out of it. And if you can't talk yourself out of the disappointment, you end up feeling shame, because I'm failing at getting in a good attitude.
Yeah.
You see that? And here's the other emotion that I think is closely tied to shame, is disgust. Because I think we all sort of walk around with this idea that we shouldn't judge people. But the emotion of disgust is really one of the primary emotions. We do have it. We're disgusted by certain people's behavior, especially, right? We tend to think of disgust as about like moldy, dirty things. But when it comes to relationships, we have disgust for people. But a lot of people won't let themselves feel disgust because they know inherently there's some judgment built into disgust, right? Yeah. And then, so they have shame about it. But again, in order to heal from mind body stuff, you got to express, be aware of your emotions, right? So if you're not aware of shame, right, and you're feeling the emotion of disgust, you might well repress it and then game over, because I'm not going to find that disgust if I haven't unearthed my shame. Do you see what I mean?
I do. Let's wrap.
You're looking at the clock.
Well, because again, we're way over, 50% over, actually. I do have a question I want to ask you off air. So don't hang up when we call this. But hey, thank you for being here. In the show notes is where you can find Ellen. So please make sure you check that out. Check out her website. Check out her socials. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks, Eddie. It's really fun, as usual.